Okay, last time we began with Romans, the first chapter, and I mentioned the sheet, right, one of these sheets, that Romans asks and answers some very basic questions. And you'll see on here questions of importance that are covered by the book of Romans. All of these things are answered in a way that is very important for us to understand the gospel. What is the gospel? Why do men need the gospel? How can a sinner be made right before God? Is the gospel in agreement with the Old Testament teachings? What are the benefits of the gospel in the life of one who believes? Is it true that the gospel of grace permits a life of sin? Does the gospel teach that Christians ought to keep the law to live a holy life? How then does a Christian live a holy life? Does the gospel mean that God has broken his promises to Israel? And how are Christians to show in their daily life that they are justified? All of these questions are brought up and answered in the book of Romans. The book of Romans is a fascinating book. It divides into three very basic, simple structures. The first part, doctrinal, chapters 1 to 8. This doctrinal portion covers everything in regards to what the gospel is, man's need for the gospel, how man is saved. It deals with how man walks in sanctification before God and obeys God. It deals with our relationship to the law and to the Holy Spirit. And chapters 1 to 8 deal with the past aspect of salvation, or freedom from the penalty of sin. Freedom from the penalty of sin, the guilt and penalty. And then the second portion is dispensational, chapters 9 to 11. It deals with Israel and God. Those Jews who heard this first 8 chapters would say, well, you trying to say that God has no longer a future for Israel? You mean the gospel has completely annulled his promises to us? So chapters 9, 10, and 11 treat the subject of God and Israel. Israel and the sovereignty of God, Israel and her failure, and Israel and her future are all covered in these three chapters. And then chapter 12 to the end, you have practical applications. Therefore, brethren, I beseech you therefore by the mercies of God that you give your bodies a living sacrifice, and begin to show how we give our bodies a living sacrifice. Practical exhortation. So the book divides into these three easy portions. And we're going to be dealing with the first portion, this portion that has to do with what is the gospel. Now, last time we talked about what the gospel was. All right, and on your sheet you have that, so I'm not going to go over it. But just in brief, verses 1 to 17 of chapter 1. Surprised to see you. How are you today? My dear nephew. Okay, chapter 1, verses 1 to 17, is dealing with what is the gospel. And we treat it, for example, what is the gospel? Where does it come from? Its origin is God. What does it have to do with? It has to do with the person of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who is of the seed of David, who lived a holy life and who rose again from the dead. And what is its power? It is the power of God to salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and then to the Gentile. So that's what we discussed last time. Chapters 1, verses 1 to 17 treat the theme of the book, the righteousness of God revealed. I remember I mentioned, and I think it's important, that this book is not dealing with the love of God in the sense of John 3:16. It is dealing with another aspect, although the love of God is here. But it's dealing with this aspect, because here's a righteous, holy God. In him is no sin. He knows no sin. He is not sin. He is absolute light, perfection. Here is sinful man who has rebelled against God. Now how can a holy God accept a sinful man and be faithful and true to his character? You see, the gospel is not God winking at sin. It isn't God becoming a softy. After a while, he says, hey, these people, they are never going to learn. We've had 3,000 years of history of the human race, and they're not going to learn. I tell you what, I'm going to start getting soft with them. They can't hack it. The gospel isn't God getting soft. The gospel isn't God winking at sin. It's a way to satisfy God's holiness, to make man righteous, and for God to be completely faithful and true to his attributes. In other words, when God declares a man or a woman righteous in Christ, he has not compromised anything in his holy character. He is still holy. And this is very important. So it's dealing with this. Okay, we talked last time about what the gospel was. What is the gospel? And we mentioned that it's the power of God to salvation. But we mentioned various things about it that are very interesting, I think. Now tonight we want to get to the second part of this. On one of these sheets, I should have numbered them. Part number 2, verses 18 of chapter 1 to chapter 3:20. All right? Verses 18 of chapter 1 to 3:20 will cover this territory. The Gentiles are guilty. It will treat the subject of how can God judge and condemn anyone who has never heard of the Word of God, has never heard of His Son. How can God do that and be just? This is a question a lot of people ask today. It comes up a lot. You mean those people out in the jungle somewhere who have never heard of God, God will judge them? What kind of a God do we have? The second thing we'll treat are that the Jews are guilty. And we'll be dealing in chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, 8 with these people. All the while, Paul is pointing a finger at the world and the heathen, so to speak. These smug people are standing there saying, yeah, give it to them, Paul. Lay it on them. That's what they are. Give it to them. Lay it on them. And then he turns right around and he says, now, let's get into you guys. If you have the law and you don't follow the law, you're guilty too. Uh-oh. So in this portion, he deals with the Jews are guilty. And then he's going to come with the verdict in chapter 3, 9 to 20, that the whole world is guilty. That there is none righteous, no, not one. That everybody is guilty before God. And this portion is really important. I mentioned at the introduction of this, when in my Marquette Bible study there at MU, we've been going through the book of Romans slowly for a year. And I told him last year, master this portion here about sin, because it answers a lot of questions. And one of the men in the study went to Japan this summer and came back and he told me it really works. Because of some of the things I learned in this portion, when I was talking to the Japanese about God, I assumed that they knew certain things in their conscience. And we're going to talk about that tonight. So the first part I have here is the Gentiles are guilty, and I have the word intelligence written here. Let's look at this. Verse 18 of chapter 1. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath shown it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power in Godhead, so that they were without excuse. Because when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. That's as far as I want to go tonight. This is interesting enough. It says the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth and unrighteousness. Now the wrath of God had been revealed, for example, in Sodom when He judged Sodom and Gomorrah. He judges and He showed His wrath upon sin. He judged the earth once with a flood and He showed His wrath upon this also. And it also says in the New Testament that there's going to become a day of God's wrath upon the nations and the earth. And I take it that what He's trying to show in this portion are really two things. One, that God has judged and will judge all sin. Now He has judged in the past and He will judge in the future. And one of the ways He has judged here is by turning men over to already experience the wrath of not following God. Look in verse 24, please. Even though that's a little ahead of where we are. Verse 24 says, "Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own heart." And then in verse 26, "For this cause God gave them up to vile affections." Alright? And then in verse 28, "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind." Now this in essence, and this in one way, is God's wrath being shown. So I'm bringing it another application. There will be a future wrath. There will be a time when He will come and judge all unrighteousness and all sin. And He's already done it in the past. He showed us that in the Old Testament. But another way He has done this, and His wrath already is hanging over the rebellious world, is because He has turned man loose to follow His own way. He has given them up, it says three times. Man gave up on God. "I will not glorify You. I need not follow You. I need not honor You." And God gave up on man. "If You judge Me not faithful, I judge You the same way. Go Your way." Experience in your lives what it is now to walk out of fellowship with Me. And so this is one of the things that He's saying here. His wrath is already in this world in a sense, although He has come to seek and to save them that are lost. And right now is the day of salvation for anyone who will believe. You can be delivered from the powers of darkness and translated to the kingdom of His dear Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. So He says the wrath of God is revealed. It has been revealed in the past. We've seen it many times in the Old Testament. It most certainly will be revealed in the future, and already is being revealed here in this world. Rebellious man has been given up to go his own way. God said, "Go your way. Experience the results of sin." This is why when people say, "How can God be a loving God and permit everything in the world to be the way it is?" God has not permitted it. It is man's choice. God is not to blame. God has turned them over, given them up. You go, since you did not want to retain Me in your knowledge. And this wrath is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness. Now the word ungodliness here means lack of reverence. Doesn't just mean conduct necessarily, but it certainly brings out the idea here of lack of reverence. Ungodliness is a direct disregard for God. This is what it is. Whether it's moral ungodliness, immoral ungodliness, it is a direct disregard for God and His person. And it says He's given them over, okay, who practice ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Now, I have this written on your notes because I think it's significant. Hold means literally to hold down or suppress. Men knew the truth about God, but did not allow it to work in their lives. They suppressed it in order to live their own life. The idea is that man in his ungodliness, in his disregard for God, is constantly suppressing and holding the truth down. The truth is there. There is something in his heart that is there. And we're going to see those in a minute when we study these big words, cosmological and teleological theology. I just thought I would throw those out. We'll see what those mean and why Paul, what he means to say by holding the truth down. Man has suppressed the truth. He holds it down. There is something in man by intuition the universal belief in God, the universal consciousness of sin. Man knows God exists by intuition. It is normal, and it is something that the natural mind assumes to be true. They hold it down. Man has done everything he could to suppress this, and even today, and man's guilt and all of his problems, psychologists, not all psychologists, but many of them will look for blame shifting. Our sin is not the result of ourselves, it is the result of something else. Some outside force, whether it be society, politics, my upbringing, you name it. There are outside forces that have acted upon me, and I cannot be what I ought to be, I will not be what I ought to be, and therefore I am not responsible for what I do. And so they hold the truth in unrighteousness. So what he says in verse 18 is really interesting. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against this disregard for God, a lack of reverence, because men are holding, suppressing truth in unrighteousness. Then he explains here in verse 19, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath shown it unto them. That which may be known of God is manifest in them. The moral condition of the human race is being spoken of here. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament show his handiwork. You know that Noah's father, this is interesting, Noah's father was alive for 50 years before Adam died. So that Noah's father had direct conversations with Adam. That's interesting. 50 years, he was a contemporary of Adam. In those days, there was a witness. In those days, there were men alive. In those days, there were people who understood the things of God. Not the way we do today, because they didn't have this revelation we do, but they understood. And that which may be known of God is manifest in them. Men know God exists by intuition. It is a universal belief in God that proves that this is by intuition. I studied anthropology years ago before I went to Columbia and used to get anthropological journals dealing with tribal people and other things. And I've always enjoyed that. And even your worldly anthropologists, your anthropologists who are Marxist, your anthropologists who are very humanistic, will admit that wherever they go, whatever tribe they discover, people have some belief in supreme being. Now, it may not be the God that we believe in. It may be demons. It may be spirits. But all men, by intuition, sense and know that there is something or someone that exists. And I think that's very interesting. Very, very interesting. An anthropologist would love to discover somewhere a tribe of people who had no belief whatsoever in anything. They would say, aha, we have found our proof. And yet it's true. Now it may be a distorted viewpoint. I remember years ago in Colombia, going up the mountain, we went to a place called Carcassi. A real hole in the wall of a place. An awful place to live. And we were going there witnessing and spending various nights in the hotel there with beds that were too small. Our feet were sticking over the end of the beds, and the mattresses were cotton thin things, and the shower was just one little pipe coming out with ice cold water. Anyway, in Carcassi, I walked up the mountains. And it's quite an interesting climb up there. Winding up the mountains, going to visit some farm boy up there, about a 2-hour walk, and huffing and puffing because we were already at about 10,000 or 11,000 feet above sea level. And I was with an old campesino man who was showing me where this particular family was. And on the way past a rock, I saw him take his hat off. We walked past the rock and he took his hat off and put his hat back on. I walked up to him and tapped him on the shoulder. What'd you take your hat off for? Come here. St. Anthony. Well, I looked at this piece of rock, you know. St. Anthony. What do you mean, St. Anthony? St. Anthony. Come here, I'll show you. See all those where you burn candles? You got to burn candles when you go by. I said, you didn't burn a candle. I took my hat off. That's all right. But you got to do something to St. Anthony. Of course, it was demonized. People had fallen off their horse there and died. Various weird things have happened. This man was tipping his hat to stone. God knows man exists by intuition, and it is universal. It is universal. It is man, something that man cannot rid himself from. It is not a result of superstition or perverted thinking. It is not the result of the fact that somebody invented the name God and invented the name Bible and began to tell us that the Bible talks about God, and therefore we suddenly had a consciousness of God. There are many people in the world who have never heard of the Bible and have never heard of our God, who by intuition know that there exists a supreme being, if I can use that term. So it is universal. By universal I mean it is common to all. It is subject to no other truth. It is belief in God that comes without the Bible. It is belief in God that comes in verse 20. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. The creation. Now, I put down some words here. Cosmological. These are some theological arguments and I'd like you just to learn a little bit about these, because I think they're interesting enough. Cosmological simply means this. God exists and is the first cause of all things. In every effect, there must be a cause. Nature cannot reproduce itself. There must be a cause. Man had looked at the creation. He looked at the universe. He looked at what was there. He looked at himself. There must be a cause. There must be a cause. There's the effect. I see the effect around me. The stars, the earth, man. So there must be a cause. So the cosmological argument simply says this: every effect must have a cause. And this is something that men have in their conscience. They've held it down, they've suppressed it, but it's there. The second argument is teleological argument, which means this: from the presence and order of the universe, His intelligence and purpose are manifested in design and function. In other words, when we see certain things in the universe, we think certain things about God. We think, for example, when we see order, we think of intelligence. When we see this, we think of power. Man has drawn certain conclusions from this. For example, let's read in Psalm 24, 9 and 10. Psalm 24, 9 and 10. Wrong. Wrong reference. I've got the wrong reference there. All right.
Maybe Psalm 19, John?
Pardon?
Maybe Psalm 19 instead?
Well, what I'm looking for, and I've got the wrong reference, so I'm looking for what said, the one who has made the eyes, can he see? The one who has made ears, can he not hear? In other words, this psalm is saying that as we see intellect of man, certain senses of man, we sense that the being who created us must have these same characteristics. He must have intelligence. He must have power. The one who created the eye, does he not see and have eyes? The one who created the ear, can he not hear? I don't know how I blew that. I must have mistyped it. So, it's interesting. The argument here is then, as man looked around and saw intelligent design and function, he began to realize that the one who caused this was also intelligent and had the same senses. Man sees, man thinks, man wills, and man from his own intuition began to feel that deity was that. So what Paul is saying in verses 19 and 20 is that man has had knowledge of God. God has shown it to them in man's conscience. He has shown it to them in design. He's shown it to them in function. And this has led man to believe that he's an intelligent being, his Godhead, it says right here, is eternal power and Godhead. That he is intelligent, that he wills, that he has power. Now it doesn't say he sent his son to the cross. It doesn't say that Jesus Christ died for our sin. But what Paul is establishing here is that man has, by intuition, universally man believes this. Because there are undeniable testimonies of himself and creation that speaks of an intellectual God. There's one more argument I wanted to put on this, and I forgot to. It's called the moral argument. Conscience, wherever you go, conscience recognizes the existence of moral laws. No matter where you go, people get bothered about things. Murder. Rape. Stealing. Even among the Indians, we would think that out there there's no order and life in their villages. That it's just a bunch of people walking around deciding to go fishing when they want to go fishing. And when they want to place, you know, they hurt. They know what's wrong. And that's why you can talk to people about sin. The moral argument then says that conscience recognizes the existence of a moral law that comes outside of the Bible. Why is it that people have done so much to destroy the Word of God, and yet people feel guilty? Our day, there's all kinds of books on I'm okay, you're okay, and they're okay, and everybody's not. The whole world, there's so many books that deal with everything. How to blame shift, everything. And yet people are guilty. People are guilty. Psychologists got man to make a lot of money off people. People are guilty no matter what people say, no matter what they read, no matter this isn't my fault, I know it, and I can live my own lifestyle, and hey, we're living in a new day. They're guilty. I told you about a woman who was here last year to speak to me. 37-year-old woman who has not been married, lived with various men, took the drug route, took the bottle route. And now, after all of that open living and all of the things that she read that said, hey, she's free, she's tremendously guilty. Awful. And so, the moral argument, conscience recognizes the existence of a moral law. Known violations of this moral law are followed by feelings of guilt and fears of judgment. This is not self-imposed. It comes from outside. See, by self-imposed, it would say society has conditioned me. Society has conditioned me. The Bible has conditioned me. The Puritan society and Puritan ethics have conditioned me. This is not self-imposed. It is something from God. So what Paul says here in these two verses, I don't know if you've ever thought that this existed in these two verses, but it does. And these two verses are very important. Because Paul is taking us back before the written law. He's taking us back to the time of Noah. He's taking us back before the law was given, before there was written revelation. And he is saying man knows, and man has always known, and man is not climbing the ladder of evolution upwards. Man basically started out here, and God turned him over to vile affections after man deserted God, and man basically has been going downhill ever since. But there are some truths you cannot deny. Man has a conscience. Man knows that God exists by intuition. The universe speaks of order and design and function, and it says right away that our Creator must have order and design and function. So this is one of the arguments here. So Paul is saying they are without excuse. They are without excuse. God gave a revelation. Man became without excuse. There is no excuse for his sin. Now let's go on a little bit here then and see in verses 21, 22, and 23, and then we'll quit. Because, now he explains a little bit about why they are without excuse. See, because when they knew God, alright, they knew God, they knew certain things about God. No, Adam lived, and men lived, and he communicated this, and you'd be surprised. And then they knew it by intuition, they knew it by their conscience, they knew it by design, they knew it by function. When man knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were they thankful, but became vain their imagination, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. This is interesting, isn't it? When they knew God, they glorified him not as God. All of it starts right there. Not giving God first place. What does it mean they glorified him not as God? It means they owed allegiance to God. They must regard God in their existence. They must accept the fact that they do not exist on their own, that they exist because of God, and they exist because of Him. They owe something to Him. Right? And they glorified Him not as God. They would not recognize His place in their lives. They would not recognize His place in their culture, in their existence. In other words, I can do it alone. I don't need you. And of course, when that happens, then the next thing is, you no longer are thankful. They weren't thankful. When you begin to see, I can make it on my own, I don't need Him, then there's no gratitude in your heart. See? Then there's nothing to thank Him for, because it's all made of my own hands. See? The survival of man is in his own hands. Making this world better is in our own hands. Everything is in our own hands. Well, why thank Him? If we owe no allegiance to Him, if we don't recognize Him as the one who created us, then why thank Him? Man should give his being over to his Creator. He's explaining here what happened, why they're without excuse. They should have given themselves over to his Creator and thanked Him, but instead they did not. They did not thank Him. And these are your steps downward. When we start losing the fact that God runs our lives, that we belong to Him, that we owe our existence to Him, when we begin to lose this sense that God created us and we are His, then we begin to lose a sense of appreciation. And this is what Paul is saying. Neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. See, their foolish heart was darkened. What happened? They thought they had light, and basically their heart became darkened. They fell to the occult. The inner man was darkened, so to speak. See, God would not force them. This is why God gave them up. Three times He said, because God isn't running them like puppets on a string. He has made man intellectually able, morally able, and He's given man will. Three attributes that God could communicate. There are some attributes He can't communicate. He will not communicate omnipotence. He will not communicate omniscience. He will not communicate omnipresent. But He has communicated will and emotion and intellect. These come when God breathed into man and made him a living soul. So man would not thank Him. And he became vain in their imagination, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And the word fools here, in the Greek, is the word morons. They became morons. That's where we get our word morons from. See? Man struggled to go on his own. He thought he was wise, and God said he's a moron. He's a moron. Lack of knowledge. Complete idiot. Bananas. Whatever it is. He doesn't know. He become a moron. He thinks he knows. But it's interesting what happened. At the same time, verse 23, man could not free himself from a knowledge of God. So he created God after man's image, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. In other words, man said, I will not glorify you. I will not thank you. I am now holding my own destiny in my hands. I don't need you. I am free from God. But the fact that they had by intuition the knowledge of God made that they created God still, but only to conform to them. get the idea? Man can't rid himself from it. So he conforms God to his own image. Creatures and beasts and four-footed things, and you name it. So I think verse 23 is very significant. That when man professed himself to be wise, and I don't need this, and God said, you're morons. Man still, by intuition, knew that God existed, and so man has created gods, but only after man's corruptible way. Because man cannot rid himself of the knowledge that God exists. And this is universally known in everybody's heart. And so what Paul is saying here is all of the idolatry in the world today, all of the occult, all of the false things, all of the things you see in these tribal people, all of the weird things, all of the false worship, whether it be San Antonio the Rock or whatever it is. It's because man can't rid himself of the knowledge of God. And yet he forgets and he refuses to acknowledge God. And so he makes these images conformable to his own corruptible image.